Hello, I'm Kristen Marchand, back again with the second half of the Op Younger Readers Theater's show entitled Christmas with Ms. Montgomery. Of course, we're talking about Lucy Maud Montgomery, the famous Canadian author of Anne of Green Gables. So it's on with some more of Ms. Montgomery's short stories about Christmas, written near the end of the 19th century or early in the 20th century. Here's Carol Peterson with Lucy Maud Montgomery's Clorinda's Gifts.
"Oh, it is such a dreadful thing to be poor a fortnight before Christmas," said Clorinda, with the mournful sigh of 17 years. Aunt Emmy smiled. Aunt Emmy was 60, and spent the hours she didn't spend in a bed on a sofa or in a wheelchair. But Aunt Emmy was never heard to sigh. "I suppose it is worse then than at any other time," she admitted. That was one of the nice things about Aunt Emmy. She always sympathized, and she always understood. "I'm worse than poor this Christmas. I'm stony broke," said Clorinda. "My spell of fever in the summer and the doctor's bills have cleaned out my coffers completely. Not a single Christmas present can I give. And I did so want to give some little thing to each of my dearest people. But I simply can't afford it. That's the hateful, ugly truth." Clorinda sighed again. "The gifts which money can purchase are not the only ones we can give," said Aunt Emmy gently, "nor the best either." "Oh, I know it's nicer to give something of your own work," agreed Clorinda. "But materials for fancy work cost too. That kind of a gift is just as much out of the question for me as any other." "That was not what I meant," said Aunt Emmy. "What did you mean, then?" asked Clorinda, looking puzzled. Aunt Emmy smiled. "Suppose you think out my meaning for yourself," she said. "That would be better than if I explained it. Besides, I don't think I could explain it. Take the beautiful line of a beautiful poem to help you when you're thinking out. The gift without the giver is bare." "I'd put it the other way and say, the giver without the gift is bare," said Clorinda with a grimace. "That is my predicament exactly. Well, I hope by next Christmas I'll not be quite bankrupt. I'm going into Mr. Callender's store down at Murray Bridge in February. He has offered me the place, you know." "Won't your aunt miss you terribly?" said Aunt Emmy. Clorinda flushed. There was a note in Aunt Emmy's voice that disturbed her. "Oh, yes, I suppose she will," she answered. "But she'll get used to it very soon. And I will be home every Saturday night, you know. I'm dreadfully tired of being poor, Aunt Emmy. And now that I have a chance to earn something for myself, I mean to take it. I can help Aunt Mary, too. I'm to get $4 a week. I think she would rather have your companionship than a part of your salary, Clorinda," said Aunt Emmy. "But, of course, you must decide for yourself, dear. It is hard to be poor." "I know it. I am poor." "You poor?" said Clorinda, kissing her. "Why, you are the richest woman I know, Aunt Emmy, rich in love and goodness and contentment." "And so are you, dearie. Rich in youth and health and happiness and ambition. Aren't they all worthwhile?" "Of course they are," laughed Clorinda. "Only, unfortunately, Christmas gifts can't be coined out of them." "Did you ever try?" asked Aunt Emmy. "Think out that question, too, in your thinking out, Clorinda." "Well, I must say bye-bye and run home. I feel cheered up. You always cheer people up, Aunt Emmy. How gray it is outdoors. I do hope we'll have snow soon." "Wouldn't it be jolly to have a white Christmas? We always have such faded brown Decembers." Clorinda lived just across the road from Aunt Emmy, in a tiny white house behind some huge willows. But Aunt Mary lived there too, the only relative Clorinda had. For Aunt Emmy wasn't really her aunt at all. Clorinda had always lived with Aunt Mary ever since she could remember. Clorinda went home and upstairs to her little room under the eaves, where the great bare willow boughs were branching athwart her windows. She was thinking over what Aunt Emmy had said about Christmas gifts and giving. "I'm sure I don't know what she could have meant," pondered Clorinda. "I do wish I could find out, if it would help me any. I'd love to remember a few of my friends at least. There's Miss Mitchell. She's been so good to me all this year, and she helped me so much with my studies. And there's Mrs. Martin out in Manitoba. If I could only send her something. She must be so lonely out there. And Aunt Emmy herself, of course. And poor old Aunt Kitty down the lane. And Aunt Mary, and, yes, Florence too, though she did treat me so meanly. I shall never feel the same to her again. But she gave me a present last Christmas, and so, out of mere politeness, I ought to give her something." Clorinda stopped short suddenly. She had just remembered that she would not have liked to say that last sentence to Aunt Emmy. Therefore, there was something wrong about it. Clorinda had long ago learned that there was sure to be something wrong in anything that could not be said to Aunt Emmy. So she stopped to think it over. Clorinda puzzled over Aunt Emmy's meaning for 4 days and part of 3 nights. Then all at once it came to her, or if it wasn't Aunt Emmy's meaning, it was a very good meaning in itself, and it grew clearer and expanded in meaning during the days that followed. Although at first Clorinda shrank a little from some of the conclusions to which it led her. "I've solved the problem for my Christmas giving for this year," she told Aunt Emmy. "I have some things to give after all. Some of them quite costly, too, that is, they will cost me something. But I know I'll be better off and richer after I've paid the price. That is what Mr. Grierson called a paradox, isn't it? I'll explain all about it to you on Christmas Day." So, on Christmas Day, Clorinda went over to Aunt Emmy's. It was a faded brown Christmas after all, for the snow had not come. But Clorinda did not mind. There was such joy in her heart that she thought it the most delightful Christmas Day that ever dawned. She put the queer, cornery armful she carried down on the kitchen floor before she went into the sitting room. Aunt Emmy was lying on the sofa before the fire, and Clorinda sat down beside her. "I've come to tell you all about it," she said. Aunt Emmy patted the hand that was in her own. "From your face, dear girl, it will be pleasant hearing and telling," she said. Clorinda nodded. "Aunt Emmy, I thought for days over your meaning, though until I was dizzy, and then one evening it just came to me without any thinking at all, and I knew that I could give some gifts after all. I thought of something new every day for a week. At first I didn't think I could give some of them, and then I thought how selfish I was. I would have been willing to pay any amount of money for gifts if I had had it. But I wasn't willing to pay what I had. I got over that, though, Aunt Emmy. Now I'm going to tell you what I did give. First, there was my teacher, Miss Mitchell. I gave her one of Father's books. I have so many of his, you know, so that I wouldn't miss one. But still, it was one I loved very much, and so I felt that that love made it worthwhile. That is, I felt that on second thought. At first, Aunt Emmy, I thought I would be ashamed to offer Miss Mitchell a shabby old book, worn with such reading and all marked over with Father's notes and pencilings. I was afraid she would think it queer of me to give her such a present. And yet, somehow, it seemed to me that it was better than something brand new and unmellowed, that old book which Father had loved and which I loved. So I gave it to her, and she understood. I think it pleased her so much, the real meaning in it. She said it was like being given something out of another's heart and life. Then you know Mrs. Martin. Last year, she was Miss Hope, my dear Sunday school teacher. She married a home missionary, and they are in a lonely part of the West. Well, I wrote her a letter. Not just an ordinary letter. Dear me, no. I took a whole day to write it. And you should have seen the postmistress's eyes stick out when I mailed it. I just told her everything that had happened in Greenville since she went away. I made it as newsy and cheerful and loving as I possibly could. Everything bright and funny I could think of went into it. The next was old Aunt Kitty. You know, she was my nurse when I was a baby, and she's very fond of me. But, well, you know, Aunt Emmy, I'm ashamed to confess it, but really, I've never found Aunt Kitty very entertaining, to put it mildly. She's always glad when I go to see her, but I've never gone except when I couldn't help it. She's very deaf and rather dull and stupid, you know. Well, I gave her a whole day. I took my knitting yesterday and sat with her the whole time and just talked and talked. I told her all the Greenvale news and gossip and everything else I thought she'd like to hear. She was so pleased and proud. She told me when I came away that she hadn't had such a nice time for years. Then there was Florence. You know, Aunt Emmy. We were always intimate friends until last year. Then Florence once told Rose Watson something I had told her in confidence. I found it out, and I was so hurt. I couldn't forgive Florence, and I told her plainly I could never be a real friend to her again. Florence felt badly because she really did love me, and she asked me to forgive her, but it seemed as if I couldn't. Well, Aunt Emmy, that was my Christmas gift to her, my forgiveness. I went down last night and just put my arms around her and told her that I loved her as much as ever and wanted to be real close friends again. I gave Aunt Mary her gift this morning. I told her I wasn't going to Murray Bridge, that I just meant to stay home with her. She was so glad, and I'm glad too, now that I've decided so. Your gifts have been real gifts, Clorinda, said Aunt Emmy. Something of you, the best of you, went into each of them. Clorinda went out and brought her cornery armful in. I didn't forget you, Aunt Emmy, she said, as she unpinned the paper. There was a rosebush, Clorinda's own pet rosebush, all snowed over with fragrant blossoms. Aunt Emmy loved flowers. She put her finger under one of the roses and kissed it. It's as sweet as yourself, dear child, she said, and it will be a joy to me all through the lonely winter days. You've found out the best meaning of Christmas giving, haven't you, dear? Yes, thanks to you, Aunt Emmy, said Clorinda.
That was Carol Peterson reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's Clorinda's Gifts. Next up is Brian Peterson with Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Osborne Christmas.
Cousin Myra had come to spend Christmas at the Firs, and all the junior Osbornes were ready to stand on their heads with delight. Darby, whose real name was Charles, did it because he was only 8, and at 8, you have no dignity to keep up. The others, being older, couldn't. But the fact that Christmas itself awoke no great enthusiasm in all the hearts of the junior Osbornes. Frank voiced the opinion of the day with after Cousin Myra had arrived. He was sitting on the table with his hands in his pockets and a cynical sneer on his face. Well, at least Frank flattered himself with what it was cynical. He knew that Uncle Edgar had said to wear a cynical sneer, and Frank admired Uncle Edgar very much and imitated him in every possible way. But to you and I, he would have looked just as he did to Cousin Myra, a very discontented and unbecoming scowl. "I'm awfully glad to see you, Cousin Myra," explained Frank carefully. "Just you being here makes some things worthwhile. But Christmas is such a bore, a regular bore." That's what Uncle Edgar called things that didn't interest him, so Frank pretty sure of his words. Nevertheless, he wondered uncomfortably what made Cousin Myra smile so queerly. "Why, how dreadful," she said brightly. "I thought all you boys looked upon Christmas as the very best time of the year." "We don't," said Frank gloomily. "It's just the same old thing, year in and year out. We know just exactly what's going to happen. We even know pretty well what presents we are going to get. And Christmas Day itself is always the same. We'll get up in the morning, and our stockings will be full of things, half of them we don't want. And then there's dinner. Oh, it's always so pokey. And all the uncles and aunts come to dinner. Just the same old crowd every year. And they say the same old things. Aunt Desda always says, 'Why, Frankie, how look how you've grown.' She knows how I hate to be called Frankie. And after dinner, they'll sit around and talk the rest of the day, and that's all. Yes, I call Christmas a nuisance." "There isn't a bit of single bit of fun in it," said Ida discontentedly. "Not a bit," said the twins both together, as they always said things. "Hey, there's lots of candy," said Darby stoutly. He rather liked Christmas, although he was ashamed to say it before Frank. Cousin Myra smothered another of those queer smiles. "You've had too much Christmas, you Osbornes," she said seriously. "It has palled on your taste, as all good things will do if you overdo them. Did you ever try giving Christmas to someone else?" The Osbornes looked at Cousin Myra doubtfully. They didn't understand. "We always send presents to our cousins," said Frank hesitantly. "That's a bore, too. They've got so many things, and there's no end of bother to think of sending them something new."
"That isn't what I mean," said Cousin Myra. "How much Christmas do you suppose those little Rolands down there in the hollow have? Or Sammy Abbott with the lame back? Or French Joe and his family over the hill? If you have too much Christmas, why don't you give some to them?"
The Osbornes looked at each other. This was a new idea.
"How could we do that?" asked Ida.
Whereupon they had a consultation. Cousin Myra explained her plan, and the Osbornes grew enthusiastic over it. Even Frank forgot what he was supposed to be wearing his cynical sneer. "I move we do it, Osbornes," he said. "If Father and Mother are willing," said Ida.
"Huh? Won't it be jolly?" exclaimed the twins.
"Well, rather," said Darby. He did not mean to be scornful. He had heard Frank saying the same words in the same tone, and thought it signified approval. Cousin Myra had a talk with Father and Mother Osborne that night, and found them heartily in sympathy with her plans. For the next week, the Osbornes were agog with excitement and interest. At first, Cousin Myra made the suggestion, but their enthusiasm soon outstripped her, and they thought out things for themselves. Never did a week pass so quickly, and the Osbornes had never had so much fun either. Christmas morning, there was not a single present given or received at the Firs, except those which Cousin Myra and Mr. and Mrs. Osborne gave to each other. The junior Osbornes had asked that the money which their parents had planned to spend on presents to be given to them the previous week, and given it was without a word. The uncles and aunts arrived in due time, but not with them was the junior Osborne's concern. They were the guests of Mr. and Mrs. Osborne. The junior Osbornes were having a Christmas dinner party of their own. In the small dining room, a table was spread and loaded with good things. Ida and the twins cooked that dinner all by themselves. To be sure, Cousin Myron had helped some, and Frank and Darby had stoned all the raisins and helped pull the homemade candy. And all together they had decorated a small dining room royally with Christmas greens. Then their guests came. First, all the little Rolands from the hollow arrived, 7 in all, with very red and shiny faces, and not a word to say for themselves, so shy were they. Then came a troop from the French Joes, 4 black-eyed lads who never knew what shyness meant. Frank drove down to the village in the cutter and brought home Lame Sammy with him, and soon after the guests arrived, little Tilly Mather, who was Miss Rankin's orphan asylum girl from over the road. Everybody knew that Miss Rankin never kept Christmas. She did not believe in it, she said, but she did not prevent little Tilly from going to the Osmonds' dinner party.
Just at first, the guests were a little stiff and unsocial, but soon they got acquainted, and so jolly was Cousin Myra, who had her dinner with the children in preference to the grown-ups, and so friendly to Junior Osborne's, that all stiffness soon vanished. What a merry dinner it was! What peals of laughter went up, reaching to the big dining room across the hall where the grown-ups had sat in their solemn state. And how those guests did eat, and frankly enjoy the good things before them. How nicely they all behaved, even the French Joes. Myra had secretly been a little dubious about those four mischievous-looking lads, but their manner was quite flawless. Mrs. French Joe had been drilling into them for 3 days, ever since they had been invited up to the big dinner Christmas party at the big house. After the merry dinner was over, the Junior Osbornes brought in a Christmas tree loaded with presents. They had bought them with the money that Mr. and Mrs. Osborne had meant for their own presents, and a splendid assortment there was. All the French Joe boys got a pair of skates apiece, and Sammy a set of beautiful books, and Tilly was made supremely happy with a big wax doll. Every little Roland got just what his or her small heart had been longing for. Besides, there were nuts and candies galore. Then Frank hitched up the pony again, but this time into a great pung sleigh, and the Junior Osbornes took their guests for a sleigh ride, chaperoned by Cousin Myra. It was just dusk when they got back, having driven the Rolands and the French Joes and Sammy and Tilly to their respective homes. "This has been the jolliest Christmas I ever spent," said Frank emphatically. "I thought we were just going to give the others a good time, but it was they who give it to us," said Ida. "Weren't the French Joes jolly?" giggled the twins. "Such cute speeches they would make." "Me and Teddy are going to be chums after this," announced Darby. "He's an inch taller than me, but I'm whiter." That night, Frank and Ida and Cousin Myra had a little talk, after the smaller Osbornes had been hauled off to bed. "We're not going to stop with Christmas, Cousin Myra," said Frank at the end of it. "We're just going to keep on going throughout the year. We never, ever had such a delightful old Christmas before." "You've learned the secret to happiness," said Cousin Myra gently, and the Osbornes understood what she meant.
That was Brian Peterson reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Osborne Christmas. Here's Lynn Stewart with Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Falsom Christmas Dinner.
"Well, so it's all settled," said Stephen Falsom. "Yes," assented Alexina. "Yes, it is," she repeated, as if somebody had questioned it. Then Alexina sighed. Whatever it was, the fact of its being settled did not seem to bring Alexina any great peace of mind, nor Stephen either, judging from his face, which wore a sort of suffer-and-be-strong expression just then. "When do you go?" said Alexina after a pause, during which she had frowned out of the window and across the Tracy yard. Josephine Tracy and her brother Duncan were strolling about the yard in the pleasant December sunshine, arm in arm, laughing and talking. They appeared to be a nice, harmless pair of people, but the sight of them did not seem to please Alexina. "Just as soon as we can sell the furniture and move away," said Stephen moodily. "Hi-ho, so this is what all our fine ambitions have come to, Lexi. Your music and my M.D. A place in a department store for you and one in a lumber mill for me." "Well, I don't dare to complain," said Alexina slowly. "We ought to be so thankful to get the positions. I am thankful, and I don't mind so very much about my music. But I do wish you could have gone to college, Stephen." "Oh, never mind me," said Stephen, brightening up determinedly. "I'm going into the lumber business enthusiastically. You don't know what unsuspected talents I might develop along that line. The worst of it is that we can't be together. But I'll keep my eyes open, and perhaps I'll find a place for you in Lessing." Alexina said nothing. Her separation from Stephen was the one point in their fortunes she could not bear to discuss. There were times when Alexina did not see how she was going to exist without Stephen. But she never said so to him. She thought he had enough to worry him without her making matters worse. "Well," said Stephen, getting up, "I'll run down to the office. And see here, Lexi, day after tomorrow is Christmas. Are we going to celebrate it at all? If so, I'd better order a turkey." Alexina looked thoughtful. "Oh, I don't know, Stephen. We're so short of money, you know, and the fund is dwindling every day. And don't you think it's a little extravagant to have a turkey for two people? And somehow, I don't feel a bit Christmassy. I think I'd rather spend it just like any other day and try to forget that it is Christmas. Everything would be so different. Oh, that's true, Lexi. And we must look after the Bobbies closely, I'll admit. When Stephen had gone out, Alexina cried a little, not very much, because she didn't want her eyes to be red against Stephen's return. But she had to cry a little. As she had said, everything was so different from what it had been a year ago. Their father had been alive then, and they had been very cozy and happy in the little house at the end of the street. There had been no mother there since Alexina's birthday 16 years ago. Alexina had kept house for her father and Stephen since she was 10. Stephen was a clever boy and intended to study medicine. Alexina had a good voice, and something was to be done about training it. The Tracys lived next door to them. Duncan Tracy was Stephen's particular chum, and Josephine Tracy was Alexina's dearest friend. Alexina was never lonely when Josie was nearby to laugh and chat and plan with. And then, all at once, troubles came. In June, the firm of which Mr. Folsom was a member failed. There was some stigma attached to the failure, too, although the blame did not rest upon Mr. Folsom, but with his partner. Worry and anxiety aggravated the heart trouble from which he had suffered for some time, and a month later, he died. Alexina and Stephen were left alone to face the knowledge that they were penniless and must look about for some way of supporting themselves. At first, they hoped to be able to get something to do in Thorndale so that they might keep their home. And this proved impossible. After much discouragement and disappointment, Stephen had secured a position in the lumber mill at Lessing, and Alexina was promised a place in a department store in the city. And to make matters worse, Duncan Tracy and Stephen had quarreled in October. It was only a boyish disagreement over some trifle, but bitter words had passed. Duncan, who was a quick-tempered lad, had twitted Stephen with his father's failure, and Stephen had resented it hotly. Duncan was sorry for and ashamed of his words as soon as they were uttered, but he would not humble himself to say so. Alexina had taken Stephen's part, and her manner to Josie assumed a tinge of coldness. Josie quickly noticed and resented it, and the breach between the two girls widened almost insensibly until they barely spoke when they met. Each blamed the other and cherished bitterness in her heart. When Stephen came home from the post office, he looked excited. "Were there any letters?" asked Alexina. "Well, rather, one from Uncle James." "Uncle James!" exclaimed Alexina incredulously. "Yes, beloved sis. Oh, you needn't try to look as surprised as I did. And I ordered the turkey after all. Uncle James has invited himself here to dinner on Christmas Day. You'll have a chance to show your culinary skill, for you know we've always been told that Uncle James was a gourmand." Alexina read the letter in a daze. It was a brief epistle, stating that the writer wished to make the acquaintance of his niece and nephew and would visit them on Christmas Day. That was all. But Alexina instantly saw a future of rosy possibilities. For Uncle James, who lived in the city and was really a great uncle, had never taken the slightest notice of their family since his quarrel with their father 20 years ago. But this looked as if Uncle James were disposed to hold out the olive branch. "Oh, Stephen, if he likes you and if he offers to educate you," breathed Alexina. "Perhaps he will if he is favorably impressed. Oh, but we'll have to be so careful. He is so whimsical and odd. At least everybody has always said so. A little thing might turn the scale either way. Anyway, we must have a good dinner for him. I'll have plum pudding and mince pie." For the next 36 hours, Alexina lived in a whirl. There was so much to do. The little house was put in apple pie order from top to bottom, and Stephen was set to stoning raisins and chopping meat and beating eggs. Alexina was perfectly reckless. No matter how big a hole it made in their finances, Uncle James must have a proper Christmas dinner. A favorable impression must be made. Stephen's whole future, Alexina did not think about her own at all just then, might depend on it. Christmas morning came, fine and bright and warm. It was more like in morning in early spring than in December, for there was no snow or frost, and the air was moist and balmy. Alexina was up at daybreak, cleaning and decorating at a furious rate. By 11 o'clock, everything was finished or going forward briskly. The plum pudding was bubbling in the pot. The turkey, Burton's plumpest, was sizzling in the oven. The shelf in the pantry bore two mince pies, upon which Alexina was willing to stake her culinary reputation. And Stephen had gone to the train to meet Uncle James. From her kitchen window, Alexina could see brisk preparations going on in the Tracy kitchen. She knew Josie and Duncan were all alone. Their parents had gone to spend Christmas with friends in Lessing. In spite of her hurry and excitement, Alexina found time to sigh. Last Christmas, Josie and Duncan had come over and eaten their dinner with them. But now, last Christmas seemed very far away. And Josie had behaved horribly. Alexina was quite clear on that point. Then Stephen came with Uncle James. Uncle James was a rather pompous, fussy old man with red cheeks and bushy eyebrows. Smells nice in here, was his salutation to Alexina. I hope it will taste as good as it smells. I'm hungry. Alexina soon left Uncle James and Stephen talking in the parlor and betook herself anxiously to the kitchen. She set the table in the little dining room, now and then pausing to listen with a delighted nod to the murmur of voices and laughter in the parlor. She felt sure that Stephen was making a favorable impression. She lifted the plum pudding and put it on a plate in the kitchen table. Then she took out the turkey, beautifully done, and put it on a platter. Finally, she popped the two mince pies into the oven. Just at this moment, Stephen stuck his head in at the hall door. "Lexi, do you know where that letter of Governor Howland's to Father is? Uncle James wants to see it." Alexina, not waiting to shut the oven door, for delay might impress Uncle James unfavorably, rushed upstairs to get the letter. She was 10 minutes finding it. Then, remembering her pies, she flew back to the kitchen. In the middle of the floor, she stopped as if transfixed, staring at the table. The turkey was gone, and the plum pudding was gone, and the mince pies were gone. Nothing was left but the platters. For a moment, Alexina refused to believe her eyes. Then she saw a trail of greasy drops on the floor to the open door, out over the doorstep, and along the boards of the walk to the back fence. Alexina did not make a fuss. Even at that horrible moment, she remembered the importance of making a favorable impression. But she could not quite keep the alarm and excitement out of her voice as she called, "Stephen!" And Stephen knew that something had gone wrong as he quickly came through the hall. "Is the turkey burned, Lexi?" he cried. "Burned? No, it's 10 times worse, gasped Alexina. "It's gone! Gone, Stephen! And the pudding and the mince pies, too! Oh, what shall we do? Who can have taken them?" It may be stated right here and now that the Falsoms never really knew anything more about the disappearance of their Christmas dinner than they did at that moment. But the only reasonable explanation of the mystery was that a tramp had entered the kitchen and made off with all the good things. The Falsom house was right at the end of the street. The narrow backyard opened on a lonely road. Across the road was a stretch of pine woods. There was no house very near except the Tracy one. Stephen reached his conclusion with a bound. He ran out to the yard gate, followed by the distracted Alexina. The only person visible was a man some distance down the road. Stephen leaped over the gate and tore down the road in pursuit of him. Alexina went back to the doorstep, sat down upon it, and began to cry. She couldn't help it. Her hopes were all in ruins around her. There was no dinner for Uncle James. Josephine Tracy saw her crying. Now Josie honestly thought that she had a grievance against Alexina. But an Alexina walking unconcernedly by with a cool little nod and her head held high was a very different person from an Alexina sitting on the back doorstep on Christmas morning, crying. For a moment, Josie hesitated. Then she slowly went out and across the yard to the fence. "What is the trouble?" she asked. Alexina forgot that there was such a thing as dignity to be kept up, or, if she remembered it, she was past caring for such a trifle.
"Our dinner is gone," she sobbed, "and there is nothing to give Uncle James to eat except vegetables, and I did so want to make a favorable impression."
This was not particularly lucid, but Josie, with a flying mental leap, arrived at the conclusion that it was very important that Uncle James, whoever he was, should have a dinner, and she knew where one was to be had. But before she could speak, Stephen returned, looking rueful. "Ah, no use, Lexi. That man was only old Mr. Byers, and he had seen no signs of a tramp. There is a trail of grease right across the road. The tramp must have taken directly to the woods. We'll simply have to do without our Christmas dinner."
"By no means," said Josie quickly, with a little red spot on each cheek. "Our dinner is all ready, turkey, pudding, and all. Let us lend it to you. Don't say a word to your uncle about the accident."
Alexina flushed and hesitated.
"Oh, it's very kind of you," she stammered, "but I'm afraid it would be too much."
"Not a bit of it," Josie interrupted warmly. "Didn't Duncan and I have Christmas dinner at your house last year? Just come and help us carry it over."
"Well, if you lend us your dinner, you and Duncan must come and help us eat it," said Alexina resolutely.
"I'll come, of course," said Josie. "And I think that Duncan will come, too, if... She looked at Stephen, the scarlet spots deepening. Stephen colored, too.
"Duncan must come," he said quietly. "I'll go and ask him."
2 minutes later, a peculiar procession marched out of the Tracy kitchen door, across 2 yards, and into the Folsom house. Josie headed it, carrying a turkey on a platter. Alexina came next with a plum pudding. Stephen and Duncan followed with a hot mince pie apiece. And in a few more minutes, Alexina gravely announced to Uncle James that dinner was ready. The dinner was a pronounced success, marked by much suppressed hilarity among the younger members of the party. Uncle James ate very heartily and seemed to enjoy everything, especially the mince pie.
"This is the best mince pie I have ever sampled," he told Alexina. "I am glad to know that I have a niece who can make such a mince pie."
Alexina cast an agonized look at Josie and was on the point of explaining that she wasn't the maker of the pie. But Josie frowned her into silence.
"Oh, I felt so guilty to sit there and take the credit. Your credit," she told Josie afterwards as they washed up the dishes.
"Nonsense," said Josie. "It wasn't as if you couldn't make mince pies. Your mince pies are better than mine if it comes to that. It might have spoiled everything if you'd said a word."
"Well, I must go home now. Won't you and Stephen come over after your uncle goes and spend the evening with us? We'll have a candy pull."
When Josie and Duncan had gone, Uncle James called his nephew and niece into the parlor and sat down before them with approving eyes.
"Well, I want to have a little talk with you two. I'm sorry I've let so many years go by without making your acquaintance, because you seem worth getting acquainted with. Now, what are your plans for the future?"
"I'm going into a lumber mill at Lessing, and Alexina is going into the T. Morse store," said Stephen quietly.
"Oh, tut, tut, tut. No, you're not. And she's not. You're coming to live with me, both of you. If you have a fancy for cutting and carving people up, young man, you must be trained to cut and carve them scientifically, anyhow. As for you, Alexina, Stephen tells me you can sing. Well, there's a good conservatory of music in town. Wouldn't you rather go there instead of behind a counter?"
"Oh, Uncle James!" exclaimed Alexina with shining eyes. She jumped up, put her arms about Uncle James' neck, and kissed him.
Uncle James said, "Oh, tut, tut, tut," again, but he liked it.
When Stephen had seen his uncle off on the 6 o'clock train, he returned home and looked at the radiant Alexina.
"Well, you made your favorable impression all right, didn't you?" he said gaily.
"But we owe it to Josie Tracy. Isn't she a brick? I suppose you're going over this evening?"
"Oh, yes, I am. I'm so tired that I feel as if I couldn't crawl across the yard, but if I can't, you'll have to carry me.
Go, I will. I can't begin to tell you how glad I am about everything. But really, the fact that you and Duncan and Josie and I are good friends again seems the best of all. I'm glad that tramp stole the dinner, and I hope he enjoyed it. I don't grudge him one single bite."
That was Lynn Stewart reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Folsom Christmas Dinner. And finally, we have Jeff Bowman with Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Joseph's Christmas.
The month before Christmas was always the most exciting and mysterious time in the Joseph household. Such scheming and planning, such putting of curly heads together in corners, such counting of small hoards, such hiding and smuggling of things out of sight, as went on among the little Josephs. There were a good many of them, and very few of the pennies. Hence the reason for so much contriving and consulting. From 14-year-old Molly down to 4-year-old Lenny, there were 8 small Josephs in all in the little log house on the prairie. So that when each little Joseph wanted to give a Christmas box to each of the other little Josephs, and something to Father and Mother Joseph besides, it is no wonder that they had to cudgel their small brains for ways and means thereof. Father and Mother were always discreetly blind and silent through December. No questions were asked, no matter what queer things were done. Many secret trips to the little store at the railway station 2 miles away were ignored, and no little Joseph was called to account because he or she looked terribly guilty when somebody suddenly came into the room. The air was simply charged with secrets. Sister Molly was the grand repository of these. All the little Josephs came to her for advice and assistance. It was Molly who, for troubled small brothers and sisters, did such sums in division as this. How can I get a 10-cent present for Emmy and a 15-cent one for Jimmy out of 18 cents? Or, how can 7 sticks of candy be divided among 8 people so that each shall have one? It was Molly who advised regarding the purchase of ribbon and crepe paper. It was Molly who put the finishing touches to most of the little gifts. In short, all through December, Molly was weighed down under an avalanche of responsibility. It speaks volumes for her sagacity and skill that she never got things mixed up or made any such terrible mistake as letting one little Joseph find out what another was going to give him. Dead secrecy was the keystone of all plans and confidences. During this particular December, the planning and contriving had been more difficult and the results less satisfactory than usual. The Josephs were poor at any time, but this winter they were poorer than ever. The crops had failed in the summer, and as a consequence the family were, as Jimmy said, on short commons. But they made the brave best of their small resources, and on Christmas Eve every little Joseph went to bed with a clear conscience. For was there not on the corner table in the kitchen a small mountain of tiny, sometimes very tiny, gifts labeled with the names of recipients and givers, and worth their weight in gold if love and good wishes count for anything? It was beginning to snow when the small, small Josephs went to bed. And when the big small Josephs climbed the stairs, it was snowing heavily. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph sat before the fire and listened to the wind howling about the house. "Well, I'm glad I'm not driving over the prairie tonight," said Mr. Joseph. "It's quite a storm. I hope it'll be fine tomorrow for the children's sake. They've set their hearts on having a sleigh ride. And it'll be too bad if they can't have it when it's about all the Christmas they'll have this year. Mary, this is the first Christmas since we came west that we couldn't afford some little extras for them, even if it was only a box of nuts and candy." Mrs. Joseph sighed over Jimmy's worn jacket, which she was mending. Then she smiled. "Never mind, John. Things will be better next Christmas, we'll hope. The children won't mind, bless their hearts. Look at all the little knick-knacks they've made for each other. Last week, when I was over at Taunton, Mr. Fisher had his store all gayified up, as Jim says, with Christmas presents. I did feel that I'd asked nothing better than to go in and buy all the lovely things I wanted, just for once, and give them to the children tomorrow morning. They've never had really nice things for Christmas. But there, we've all got each other in good health and spirits, and a Christmas wouldn't be much without those if we had all the presents in the world." Mr. Joseph nodded. "That's so. I don't want to grumble, but I tell you I did want to get Maggie a real live doll, as she calls it. She never has had anything but homemade dolls, and that small heart of hers is set on a real one. There was one at Fisher's store today, a big beauty with red hair and eyes that opened and shut. Just fancy Maggie's face if she saw such a Christmas box as that tomorrow morning." "Well, don't let's fancy it," laughed Mrs. Joseph. "It's only aggravating. Talking of candy reminds me, I made a big plate full of taffy for the children today. It's all the Christmassy I could give them. I'll get it out and put it on the table along with the children's presents. That can't be someone at the door. It is, though, said Mr. Joseph, as he strode to the door and flung it open. Two snowed-up figures were standing on the porch, and as they stepped in, the Josephs recognized one of them as Mr. Ralston, a wealthy merchant in a small town 15 miles away. Late hour for callers, isn't it? Said Mr. Ralston. Fact is, our horse is about given out, and the storm is so bad that we can't proceed. This is my wife, and we're on our way to spend Christmas with my brother's family in Lindsay. Can you take us in for the night, Mr. Joseph? Well, certainly, and welcome, exclaimed Mr. Joseph heartily. If you don't mind a shakedown by the kitchen fire for the night. My, my, Mrs. Ralston, as his wife helped her off with her things, you are snowed up. I'll see to putting your horse away, Mr. Ralston. This way, if you please. When the two men came stamping into the house again, Mrs. Ralston and Mrs. Joseph were sitting at the fire, the former with a steaming hot cup of tea in her hand. Mr. Ralston put the big basket he was carrying down on a bench in the corner. "Well, I thought I'd better bring our Christmas flummery in," he said. "You see, Mrs. Joseph, my brother has a big family, so we're taking them a lot of Santa Claus stuff." Mrs. Ralston packed this basket, and goodness knows what she put in it, but she half cleaned out my store. The eyes of the Lindsay youngsters will dance tomorrow, that is, if we ever get there. Mrs. Joseph gave a little sigh in spite of herself and looked wistfully at the heap of gifts on the corner table. How meager and small they did look, to be sure, beside that bulging basket with its cover suggestively tied down. Mrs. Ralston looked, too. "Santa Claus seems to have visited you early," she said with a smile. Then the Josephs laughed. "Our Santa Claus is somewhat out of pocket this year," said Mr. Joseph frankly. "Those are the little things the small folks here have made for each other. They've been at it a month, and I'm always kind of relieved when Christmas is over and there are no more mysterious doings. We're in such cramped quarters here that you can't move without stepping on somebody's secret." A shakedown was spread in the kitchen for the unexpected guests, and presently the Ralstons found themselves alone. Mrs. Ralston went over to the Christmas table and looked at the little gifts half tenderly and half pityingly. "They're not much like the contents of our basket, are they?" she said, as she touched the calendar Jimmy had made for Molly out of cardboard and autumn leaves and grasses. "Is that just what I was thinking?" returned her husband. "And I was thinking of something else, too. I have a notion that I'd like to see some of the things in our basket right here on this table." "I'd like to see them all," said Mrs. Ralston promptly. "Let's just leave them here, Edward. Roger's family will have plenty of presents without them, and for that matter, we can send them ours when we go back home." "Just as you say," agreed Mr. Ralston. "I like the idea of giving the small folk of this household a rousing good Christmas for once. They're poor, I know, and I dare say pretty well pinched this year, like most of the farmers hereabout after the crop failure." Mrs. Ralston untied the cover of the big basket. Then the two of them, moving as stealthily as if engaged in a burglary, transferred the contents to the table. Mr. Ralston got out a small pencil and a notebook, and by dint of comparing the names attached to the gifts on the table, they managed to divide theirs up pretty evenly among the little Josephs. When it was all done, Mrs. Ralston said, "Now, I'm going to spread that tablecloth carelessly over this table. We will be going before daylight, probably, and in the hurry of getting off, I hope that Mr. and Mrs. Joseph will not notice the difference till we're gone." It fell out as Mrs. Ralston had planned. The dawn broke fine and clear over a vast white world. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph were early astir, and breakfast for the storm-stayed travelers was cooked and eaten by lamplight. Then the horse and sleigh were brought to the door, and Mr. Ralston carried out his empty basket. "I expect the trail will be heavy," he said, "but I guess we'd get to Lindsay in time for dinner anyway. Much obliged for your kindness, Mr. Joseph, and when you and Mrs. Joseph come to town, we'll hope to have a chance to return it. Goodbye and a Merry Christmas to you all." When Mrs. Joseph went back to the kitchen, her eyes fell on the heaped-up table in the corner. "What?" she said, and snatched off the cover. One look she gave, and this funny little mother began to cry, but they were happy tears. Mr. Joseph came too and looked and whistled. There really seemed to be everything on that table that the hearts of children could desire. 3 pairs of skates, a fur cap and collar, a dainty work basket, 6 gleaming new books, a writing desk, a roll of stuff that looked like a new dress, a pair of fur-topped kid's gloves just Molly's size, and a china cup and saucer. All these were to be seen at the first glance, and in one corner of the table was a big box filled with candies and nuts and raisins, and in the other a doll with curling golden hair and brown eyes, dressed in real clothes with all her wardrobe and a trunk beside her. Pinned to her dress was a leaf from Mrs. Ralston's notebook with Maggie's name written on it. "Well, this is Christmas with a vengeance," said Mr. Joseph. "The children will go wild with delight," said his wife happily. They pretty nearly did when they all came scrambling down the stairs a little later. Such a Christmas had never been known in the Joseph household before. Maggie clasped her doll with shining eyes, and Molly looked at the workbasket that her housewifely little heart had always longed for. Studious Jimmy beamed over the books, and Ted and Hal whooped with delight over the skates. And as for the big box of good things, why, everybody appreciated that. That Christmas was one to date from in that family. I'm glad to be able to say, too, that even in the heyday of their delight and surprise over their wonderful presents, the little Josephs did not forget to appreciate the gifts they had prepared for each other. Molly thought her calendar just too pretty for anything, and Jimmy was sure the new red mittens which Maggie had knitted for him with her own chubby wee fingers were the very nicest, gayest mittens a boy had ever worn. Mrs. Joseph's taffy was eaten, too. Not a scrap of it was left. And as Ted said loyally, it was just as good as the candy in the box and had more chew to it besides.
That was Jeff Bowman reading Lucy Maud Montgomery's The Joseph's Christmas. And so ends our basket of Christmas short stories written by Ms. Montgomery, also well known internationally as Lucy Maud Montgomery. We hope you enjoyed this little gift today, offered up in the Christmas spirit by 8 members of the Opeonga Readers Theatre that include Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chapasky, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, Carol and Brian Peterson, Lynn Stewart, and Mark Wormke. I'm Kristen Marchand, and on behalf of our producer, Barry Conway, we'd like to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Good day, and God bless.